Good morning, everybody. Thank you for this nice introduction. I want to first thank the organizers. I mean, it's an extraordinary meeting, gathering people from such different disciplines to talk, to interact, and maybe we can squeeze out something out of it. So that's the hope. And I want to say that everything works perfectly, so you're probably put a lot of work into this. So if it works like this, then it's really very well organized. So congratulations on that, Maxime. So what I would like to talk to you about today is optical magnetometry, and I was requested to give you this review of optical magnetometry to give you a feeling what the discipline is. Which is actually quite difficult because, on the one hand, some of the most noble representatives of this disciplines are sitting in this audience. On the other hand, I think there are some people who never heard about it or heard very, very little. But I will do my best. I will try to compromise between these two requirements. So, what optical magnetometer is? It is a device that detects magnetic fields based on the detection of the properties of light transmitted through a medium subject to a magnetic field. So you detect intensity, you detect polarization, and then you can say what the magnetic field is. And thanks to the work of Dima, Mike, Derek, Vitek, and many other people, this field was pushed forward over the last decade to its today's boundaries, meaning that this sensor are currently the most sensitive magnetic field sensors that you can use for detecting magnetic fields. So what I would like to do today during this talk is to tell you how they work, what they can be used for, and finally, what's our idea of using a network of such magnetometers to probe physics beyond the standard model. So let me start with a simple cartoon. We start with an atom, which consists of a nucleus and an electron. They have spin, and of course, if there is interaction between electron and atom, they couple to a total spin of the system. However, when the atom is in thermal equilibrium, we don't really know which directions this spin points out, because we have equal probability that this is oriented in any direction in space. So we have to break this symmetry somehow, and usually we break this symmetry in optical magnetometers by illuminating atoms with light. So if there is a stream of photons that illuminate the atom, photon can be absorbed, and then spin of the photon can be transferred to atom, and we break the symmetry of the system, and now we choose a particular orientation in space of this total spin. So, of course, with angular momentum, with spin, we have a magnetic moment associated. So we have magnetic moment, we have magnetic field. So now, when we place the whole thing inside a magnetic field, the system starts to precess, right? We have a magnetic precession, which is governed by the Hamiltonian B dot S, of course, and we have a magnetic precession. And what is the most important in this system? We are modulating optical properties. We are modulating optical properties of this system, because when spins are oriented in one direction, of course, they cannot absorb, for example, any more photon. But when you tilt them by 180, they preferentially absorb photons. So we can modulate optical properties of the medium. So these optical properties are modulated to the Larmor frequency, or some multiplicity of the Larmor frequency. So this gives us an easy access to the magnetic field. But of course, this is a simple pictorial representation. We know that there is a Heisenberg uncertainty principle. We know that in the real system, we are not dealing with a single atom. We are dealing with ensemble, say 10 to the 9th or 10 to the 10th or even more atoms. So actually, the sensitivity or the precision with which you can determine the magnetic field is determined by the ability to check, to measure the orientation or the precession of spins in an external magnetic field. So when you look at, when you take, have a closer look into the sensitivity of this system, you'll find that at the most fundamental levels, there are three limiting factors that limits the sensitivity. Of course, we are dealing with atoms, so atoms have to limit the sensitivity, photons, so photons are limiting, and then the mutual interaction between them. So we have three main contributions to the sensitivity of this system. So what about the photon contribution? Well, we know that photons are particles that are described with a Poissonian statistic, and as such, they have a fluctuations in their number, in their average number. So we cannot say exactly what is the state of our light. If there's, for example, what is the intensity of light, because there are some fluctuations. There is a mean value, but there are fluctuations at any given time in this number. And then what is, for example, polarization, which is determined by the same difference of number of photons, for example, into eigenstate of light. So in such way, I mean, because of the fact that we cannot really determine what is the polarization of light we are detecting, we are limiting also the ability to determine the spin orientation. And in fact, if you take the numbers and you assume that your signal in your system is proportional to the number of photons, if it's a linear process, for example, then your noise is proportional to square number of photons. So when you want to really have a good signal to noise ratio in your system, you have to increase the number of photons. So you have to work at relatively high number of photons, high intensity. On the other hand, you have the back action, so which means that your probing light, the light that is used to check how well what your orientation of spins, can of course affect your system. The simple example would be your spin are precessing and you're absorbing photons, so you're changing the state of your system. But there's another contribution that comes from the Stark shift. So if you have AC Stark shift, when you have light which is not absorbed by the system, but it can still change slightly the difference, the energy difference between the levels that you are coupling your system to, and if you do this, you are changing your precession or evolution frequency, and of course, since photons fluctuate, then you have an uncertainty that you superimpose the photon fluctuation, superimpose the fluctuation, their number on the precession of your system. So if you take the numbers once again and look closely, you'll find that AC Stark shifts scales as with a number of photons. So if you take a back action limit, so we are assumed this is a fluctuation we showed before due to Poissonian statistics, you have your back action limit. So if you want to really, it seems that if you really want to reduce this back action limit, the easiest scenario would be to reduce the number of photons. But luckily, so we have two counter requirements. From one side, you want to have a lot of photons to have a good signal to noise ratio due to photon shot noise. On the other hand, due to back action, you have very little. So it would seem you have two counter requirements, but luckily, what you can do, this Stark shift also depends on the tuning. So you can play with some tricks to reduce the Stark shift in your system, to reduce this problem, while you can crank up the light power, so that you can reduce both of this contribution to relatively low level. To such a low level that the last contribution coming from atoms is the most significant contribution. Of course, what we are trying to do here is that we are trying to measure spins. We are trying to say what is the spin orientation in a specific direction. And of course, since two spatial directions, spatial orientations of spins are non-commuting observables, you have limit due to Heisenberg uncertainty principle. So if you take this limit and recalculate this, you will end up in an equation which Dima likes to call equation one, which is the most fundamental equation in optical magnetometry, that tells you that your atomic limit on the sensitivity with which you can detect your atoms depends, well, on one hand, on what's in your system, so what type of atoms do you have, but also on the number of atoms, on the length of your measurement that you can perform, and on the transverse relaxation of your spin polarization. So these are three parameters that can be played with when you deal with a specific species in your system. So we can prolong measurement, but sometimes, of course, it is not possible. For example, I want to have some finite bandwidth. I want to measure some changes, say within a kilohertz bandwidth. So I don't want to. I cannot prolong this for too long. On the other hand, you can try to use denser samples. So you want to have as many atoms as possible, or you want to have relatively slow relaxation. So your relaxation time ought to be good.
So this is usually works in the gas, right?
I would say it's general. That's what the next slide. Well, okay. So I'll respond to this in the following slide. So let's first look into tau, which is transverse relaxation. What is this transverse relaxation? Well, when you assume that you have, when you start with a sample that is spin polarized, you have many samples, and they start to precess in an external magnetic field. If the field is equal, you see you have some net polarization that precess with the same frequency, and this is actually the thing that you are sensitive to. So you can detect what is the precession frequency. But on the other hand, when you start with the spins that were initially polarized, but the fields locally are different, then your initial net polarization deteriorates, and over some time you are not seeing any signal in your magnetometer because there is no net polarization in your system. Of course, there are some tricks that in some situation you can reverse this process, as we've heard from Misha Lukin 2 days ago, but still, this is the main mechanism of relaxation. So, what causes those dephasing or this random evolution? Well, I'd say the most important contribution comes from inhomogeneities or a local tilt that your spin experiences. So first of all, you can have magnetic fields. So you are changing your evolution in different places in your sample, and then you are having electric fields via AC or DC stark shift. Your evolution locally can be different, and it goes to Maxim's question. So the first choice would be, based on equation one, let's use solid state materials where you have 10 to the 23 atoms per cubic centimeters, but of course, since there are such a strong field in homogeneities in your system, they dephase, and this transverse relaxation time for this system is usually pretty short. So you're not winning anything in going to solid state. In contrast, you're actually winning something in going to dilute gases, where the transverse relaxation time, or the coherence time, you can say, is much longer. It is long because when you choose some gases, for example, alkalis, you can work at relatively low densities, at vapor pressures that are 10 to minus 6, 10 to minus 5 torr. So this is relatively good vacuum, which means that the collisions, the interaction between the atoms is very weak because the mean free path between two collisions is on the order of several hundreds of meters. So you want to work with these gases, but at the same time, they have very strong transitions that allows you to probe and to pump, to prepare, to polarize your sample before your measurement. And those lines, that you would like to address, can be easily addressable with diode lasers somewhere between 750 to 900 nanometers. So you can really manipulate with the spin, with your spin sample, using some relatively low power lasers. So let's come back to our equation one, and let's ask ourselves a question, which is, so what can I do if I have my sample, my vapor, atomic vapor sample? What can I do with equation one? Well, I can try to increase density of my sample. I can try to increase the number of atoms. And the easiest way would be, since this is excuse me, since this is atomic vapor, by increasing the temperature, you can also increase the.
Would you like some water?
Maybe.
Yeah.
Thank you, ma'am. Dima requested some too. Anyway, what it says, it roughly says that every 5 degrees you can increase your concentration by a factor of 2. So you would say, okay, I want to work with much denser samples. For example, I want to increase the temperature by 100 degrees C or maybe more. And then I will gain some sensitivity in my system. Is it true? Well, not completely true, I'd say. I'll show you why. So this is this other term that's sitting in this equation, that is the transverse relaxation time of your system. So there are various mechanism that contributes to this relaxation time. They are listed in here. There are some examples, at least, are listed in here. And collision with the walls and spin exchange collisions are these two, which I will discuss in a little more detail right now. So why collisions with the walls are killing our polarization? Well, this is quite easily understood. If you have a polarized atom and it collides with the wall, when it sits in the wall or approaches the wall, it starts to feel magnetic and electric field from all the silicon and oxygen atoms that are in our glass. Then they are very random. So after being bounced off the wall, you cannot say anything about the orientation of your atom. So this atom is actually unpolarized. So you are losing, by collisions with the wall, you're losing your polarization. So how do you deal with this? Well, simply do not let your atom to collide with the wall. How can you do this? Well, you can put something on your inner wall which prevents from this interaction with the atom with the glass. And for many years, people are putting different materials. For a long time, it was paraffin was the best one, but quite recently, Dima demonstrated that the best of the materials can withstand roughly 10 to the 6th wall collisions before it's being depolarized. So that's one approach. The other approach is, instead of using coating of inner walls, let's add some extra gas into our system, buffer gas, which could be, for example, a noble gas. And then the atoms, the pressure of the noble gas is much higher than the pressure of your alkali. So the atoms bounce very often with the noble gas. And the noble gas to first order is not introducing any relaxation in your system. So these two solutions are actually quite often used in optical magnetometers. So now let me come back to this question of operation at high concentrations. And the other contribution, as we said, to the transverse relaxation was spin exchange collisions. Spin exchange collision is a collision when you have two atoms that have some polarization, they collide, they reverse their spins, electron spins, and they go away. So the problem with this is, thank you, might be a little too much for me.
No, but...
Okay, so you have, but since, as I showed you at the very beginning, I have a coupling between electron spins that I'm affecting with this collision and nuclear spin, what I can do actually, I can induce a transition between two hyperfine levels in my alkali. And the problem is that the gyromagnetic ratio in two alkalized hyperfine states is different. So if I assume I have two spins that precess synchronously, and then one of the atoms interacts with the other with the spin exchange collisions, I change the hyperfine state so they start to precess in the wrong directions and then they dephase. So I would say, what's the rate of this? What's the rate of these collisions? And the answer is given by this equation. So it depends, of course, on the concentration, on the velocity of your system, and roughly, and what sort of an atom are you using. So if you take this rate, you'd say, okay, this, when you increase the temperature, the rate of collision increases significantly. So at some point, you reach the level where this is dominant relaxation mechanism in your system. So if you increase number of atoms, at the same time you are shortening the lifetime of your polarization until the point when they are both compensating one another, and it would be an end of the story if not for Will Hopper and Mike Romalis, who found that when you actually go to very high atomic concentration, you'll find that you can reduce this relaxation. So simply, atoms are, you can understand in the following way, atoms are colliding so often that they cannot really, you're only changing your spin. There's no enough time for the spin to talk to your nuclear spin, to recouple, so that you don't really care what's the orientation of your spin. So your system becomes polarized, even they are colliding very fast. And this is this mechanism that allow Mike to achieve the lowest sensitivity. I mean, the highest sensitivity, but the lowest level on the sensitivity.
Sorry. I don't think what you just said would mean that you have to have spin exchange collision rate equal to hyperfine transition rate, but that's not the parameter. But maybe it's a detail.
Oh. Yeah. Okay. We can discuss it a little later. So this is the lowest sensitivity ever achieved for detecting of magnetic fields. So we have this most sensitive magnetometers, and now the question is what we can do with this. Well, to tell you this, let me turn to our own work and talk to you about slightly different type of the optical magnetometer that exploits so-called nonlinear magneto-optical rotation. Nonlinear magneto-optical rotation is simply a Faraday effect, but it's in its nonlinear version. So the rotation of the polarization plane depends on the light intensity. So when you have this effect in, for example, alkalis, say you have your atoms contained in paraffin-coated cells, and you measure the dependence on the rotation angle on your magnetic field, you'll find that around zero magnetic field, you have some very nice curve that has linear part in the center, and then it falls down to zero for a stronger magnetic field. So the idea to use this curve for detecting magnetic fields is quite simple. If you have such a system, you can detect rotation of your polarization plane, and if you have calibrated curve, you can say what magnetic field that corresponds to. And interestingly, this allows you to measure magnetic fields with very high precision, 10 to minus 15 tesla per root hertz. Root hertz, this normalization to root hertz means that you are measuring roughly over a second. So you can measure changes of the field on the order of 10 billionths of the Earth magnetic field. So that's how precise these devices are. Unfortunately, they can be used only for detection of a very weak magnetic field, because if you go to the stronger fields, then you cannot really say, distinguish if it's this field, which corresponds to this rotation, or this thing that corresponds to this rotation. Or to make things even worse, when you go to higher and higher fields, your curve is flattening, So you are not getting any rotation, even that you are in a strong magnetic field. So if you want to use this technique, so what you have to do, you have to either shield external magnetic fields and operate at very weak field environment, which is not always possible, or you have to actively compensate your system. So you have coils that compensate your generate magnetic field that compensate your system to zero, but then you suffer from the reduction of the sensitivity. That's why we need to have another technique that will allow us to measure magnetic fields, stronger magnetic fields. So we'd like to have a technique that allows us to measure stronger magnetic fields. And this was developed already in 2006, I believe. It was based first on Dima's idea on frequency-modulated nonlinear magnetic optical rotation. Here, we modulate intensity of the light. So we are not shining, illuminating atoms with a continuous magnetic field, but we are strobing it. We are strobing the light. And if you do this, you'll find that in addition to this zero field resonance, you're getting some new resonances, high field resonances in your system. So how can we use this? Well, first of all, what are those resonances? So this is our zero field resonance. In this particular situation, it's much smaller than it should be in zero field, but here it is. And here we have two high field, what we call high field resonances. Interestingly, the position of these resonances is very strictly determined by the modulation frequency. So if you have a specific modulation frequency, this resonance could be will appear at a specific magnetic field. So we have a resonance that position is tunable, which is as narrow as the zero field resonance and has similar amplitude as this zero field resonance. So now we can detect magnetic fields, non-zero magnetic fields, with a similar precision. And here is an algorithm of how such measurement could look like. So you take your magnetometer. This is a signal versus modulation frequency. So now the magnetic field is set, and you are scanning the modulation frequency, and you are observing a very, very pronounced signal in your rotation. And amplitude is given like here, and the phase more or less looks like shown in here. So what you do right now, you are measuring amplitude and phase of your system. If you are in resonance, your amplitude of your rotation should be maximum, as shown here, and your phase should be at zero. So this system, we have two characteristic points that allows us to find an optimum condition for this system. So if you are in resonance, this resonance condition is fulfilled. So by measuring modulation frequency, you can know what the magnetic field is. Now, if the magnetic field changes a little bit, this resonance shifts toward higher or lower frequency, depending on the direction of the change. And now, within that, you build your system in such a way that within a feedback loop, you bring this modulation frequency back to the resonance. And with such an approach, you can actually detect magnetic fields quite precisely. So what we did, we constructed the apparatus around 2006. It consists of a laser. This is the heart of our system, a vapor cell. We have a device, acousto-optical modulator, that generates these blinks of light. Everything is put in magnetically shielded environment to have a good control over the system. And we measure rotation, our polarization state of light that is transmitted through the system. So it works quite nicely, but as you see, this is not a real sensor. If you want to have a real sensor and you want to measure magnetic field, it's very hard to take your optical table with you and drag it to some place. So sometime later, we miniaturized all this into a sensor that is more or less of, I don't know, 10 centimeters in diameter and maybe 20 centimeters in length. And it's all fiber coupled, so you can really take it and bring it, for example, close to somebody's chest to do measurements that I will show you in a second. So this is this new sensor. This new sensor has some advantages over different sensors, but the previous version of our sensor. So now we can check how it works. And here are its performance. So with this sensor, we can track magnetic field with relatively broad dynamic range, more or less from zero to something like twice the Earth magnetic field, which is important because we can measure precisely fields outside our shield. And then how precisely? Well, these are some plots that shows you that the sensitivity is on the order of 10 to minus 13, 10 to minus 14 Tesla per root hertz, which is roughly an order of magnitude worse from what you would expect from a zero field measurement. So we have now this technique that is sensitive, that has a broad dynamic range. So in particular, you can use it for detection of the fields outside the shield. And you can. And what can we do with this? Well, to tell you, you have to look into the magnetic field ranges that we can deal with. So this is like more or less the scale of magnetic field that can be that can exist in nature, starting from a strong magnetic field within the atom, heavy atom, up to the very weak magnetic fields that are generated by a single operating neuron. So this is the field on the order of 10 to minus 15 Tesla. Somewhere in the middle is the Earth magnetic field that would work as our reference frame in this system. So I would like you to remember this number, which is 10 to minus 8, which is a railway traction from a distance of roughly a kilometer. So this is 10 to minus 8, and the hard magnetic field at its peak is 10 to minus 9. So coming back to applications. So there are two groups. I would say scientific applications and applications, like practical applications. So scientific, of course, these will be discussed in a second. But then, of course, astronomy, paleomagnetism, archaeology, geology. There are a few fields, many fields in which optical magnetometers can be used for extracting some important information. And of course, there are some other more practical where the money is, really. Plus, there is one interesting one that I like, which is medicine. And I would like to spend a couple of minutes talking about this practical application. So human body, it's gonna have some trivialities now. So human body, it's a complex electromagnetic system where signals are transmitted via motion of charges of ions. So we have small electric currents. So this human body generates a magnetic field. And all the organs, in fact, generate magnetic field. Heart, liver, stomach, brain, of course, generate magnetic fields. And among of those, this is the first, because this is the first that people try to measure magnetic field generated by heart, because this is the strongest source of magnetic field in human body. So heart, we know this is quite an extraordinary organ, which contracts statistically 2 billion times during man's life, pumping in this time 200 Olympic swimming pool of blood, and it's more or less independent from the brain to some extent, of course. And as such, yeah. So as such an exploit organ, there are various diagnostic techniques that are used to detect its state or its condition. And of course, electromagnetism is one of these techniques. The technique that you know, it's simple, it's inexpensive, it's well established, it's 120 years old actually. So it's very good because it can be used in many places, but it has its limitations. The limitations are it sometimes, in some situations, is indecisive. So in some tests, some problems with your heart may not appear even if they exist. So this is indecisive is quite an important problem. Plus, you are not able to really extract information of the heart condition in its interior because heart is a pretty good electric conductor. So you are not seeing there's a good electric shielding of this system. So this is why people turned their attention many years ago to magnetocardiography using squids, and now over and over again we are trying to use optical magnetometers for this measurement. So this is a traditional measurement of electric potential. So this is ECG, and this is actually the first measurement that we did with magnetocardiography. So we have a patient, or we have a friend of ours that was placed inside the magnetic shield that has nothing to do with this wonderful magnetic shield of yours. It was a cylinder of maybe that length. So we had to find the smallest PhD students in our department that we can actually squeeze inside, and we'll see him. We were measuring his heart beating. He got a nice bed inside. He felt asleep because there was a lot of story to this measurement.
I would recommend a long distance runner because they're very slim and they have a very strong heart.
Well, yeah. Actually, it's not too short. It's not too long, so that's the problem. And it's closed on one side. That's why it's another. That's another problem. So anyway, what we see, you see some magnetocardiographic signal, which looks pretty bad. But actually, we're very, very happy to see any signals in this situation because this signal has some important signatures. First of all, it is periodic, so it means that it's generated by our patient's hearts. Then, if you look very carefully, you'll see that this magnetic pulse comes a little ahead of this electric pulse, which means that something is happening first to the heart that we are not typically detecting with ECG. And finally, it gives you this potential to really extract the information about whole heart, right? Because magnetic field that you are recording is coming not only from the surface of your heart, but from every single place in your heart, because within this frequency range, say 100 hertz, magnetic human body is completely transparent to the magnetic field.
How do you know that the delay is not the calibration problem?
Well, the delay is not a calibration. Well, this is a... So I would say we ran a lot of tests on this, and we took different sets of data. We overlapped the data. We tried to different arrangements, and it seems it's consistent among the measurements.
What's the bandwidth of the detector in this case?
This is roughly 100 hertz. This is the first generation. It's really bad. We are working right now on something that should be much better, hopefully. And we are assuming that the bandwidth should be 1 kilohertz. So that's the bandwidth we are aiming at. So if it's, I wrote to you that this should give you some 3D information. So the question is, can you generate a map of this magnetic field? And in fact, we first simulated some field generated by set of coils, and was in great agreement with measurements with simulations. So we decided to take this guy once again, place him inside, and measure his magnetic field above his chest, placing our magnetometer, our sensor, in this point. So when you do this, when you measure this map, you see how the magnetic field is changing over time. So here is time. This is roughly 1 second from here to here. It's one heartbeat. And you see at this chest, the magnetic field is changing. And that's something that people have seen before, but it's also an important information that what we are actually measuring is a real heart beating, because it's more or less consistent with the knowledge that we have.
Which point in the heart is this yellow diagram for?
So this is time. So this is time flow in this direction. So this map is changing over time.
But which point in the heart, inside the heart?
This is ECG signal. So this is like actually an electron attached to your wrist. So this is not a particular. I cannot say which part of the heart this comes from. So we have this initial measurements, but of course, if you want to do this right, you have to now upgrade this system. First of all, you have to increase the sensitivity. Then if you want to use it in a practical application, you want to have it automatized, that when you turn on the switch, it starts to measure. And this is something we are working on. The other problem is addressing an inverse problem, which is ill-posed problem when you don't know. In general, it's ill-posed problem, so you have to superimpose some limitations on this to get a map of the current flowing through your heart. And finally, we are collaborating with some cardiologists. I hope that pretty soon, like within 2 years, maybe we'll be able to place the system in clinical trial to check, to measure some of the patients in a real world environment. So this is one of the applications of this technique. There is many others, but since we came here to talk about some fundamental physics problem, so let me turn to this last part of my talk. So as I said before, optical magnetometers are very sensitive devices, but in fact, optical magnetometers are not sensitive to magnetic field per se. They are sensitive to the precession frequency of their spins in magnetic field, and we are assuming this precession is induced by magnetic field. But of course, they are sensitive to any shift, any couplings that would result in a shift of magnetic sublevels. So they are ideally suited for all these investigations of non-magnetic couplings. So here's one example of some exotic spin coupling, which would demonstrate like this. If you have your field along an exotic field along the magnetic field, the precession frequency is different when you have them opposite. So this exotic field could be either induced by electric field or by gravitational field, but this is something that people are doing by, for example, switching electric field back and forth or bringing your mass closer and farther from to your system. So this was done already. So you have some control in all this experiment. You have some control over your system because you can modulate your hypothetical interaction. But anybody who ever did some measurement and sit in the lab tries to measure to have an optimized system, you'll found that your response of your system is not really flat. So there is something going on. So for example, in here, you have a drift of your readout of your magnetic field. You have very short, very, very sharp spikes, which you associated with noise. And we always say there's a lot of potential sources of this noise or this drift that are present in your system. So what you do, you're working very hard to eliminate this noise. And there's a problem. What if this is not noise? What if this is something real? What if, for example, this is some transient coupling that appears at your system that shifts your modulation, your precession frequency, and you're actually averaging this out? So that's something we talked a lot about in here. So if it's a transverse coupling, really, it's extremely hard to be measured because it's very hard to differentiate this from like a normal noise, right? So you have a noise, how would you differentiate this? So particular challenges, if you want to measure some transient couplings, would be, you know, you have to have a magnetometer that has high bandwidth and high sensitivity to exotic couplings, but at the same time, very little sensitivity to any magnetic field coupling. And then you want to eliminate this from your system. So this is the place where our GNOME network or LOBA network come about. So instead of using one magnetometer, what if we take a lot of these magnetometers, we place them in various places in the world, and we run them in perfectly shielded environment? Of course, each of the magnetometers will give us some readout, which is more or less flat, and then some response to the noise in your system. But one interesting innovation, I'd say, to the system is now we run them synchronously. If you do so, you can eliminate local noise, because when you do correlations between readouts of different magnetometers, you will be able to suppress local noise, for example, jump in your frequency of your laser or some electrical coupling. In fact, what you can do, you can, with doing correlations, you have the ability to identify global disturbances, like a transient disturbances in your system. It could be either of magnetic origin, but then when you measure something that sits inside your shield, outside the shield, this disturbance should be much stronger. So by correlating this to, you can say this is of magnetic origin. But then at the same time, you can so thanks to this, you can identify the disturbances that comes from some non-magnetic origin. Plus, if it comes to you, if it's this disturbance propagated in space, you can say by measuring, by having good enough time resolution scale, you can say this was first here, then here, and you know, you see how it propagates. So you can also have some directional sensitivity in your system. So what do you have to do to have such network? Of course, you have to have a sensitive optical magnetometers. You have to have a global timing, and we've heard already that the only global timing that gives you good enough time resolution is GPS. We have to have a system that exchanges data, and you have to develop some fancy data analysis procedures. So what can it be used for? Well, I'll give you one, but I actually still hope that we can generate some new ideas on what it's gonna be. So we've seen this a couple of times already, and of course axions are this good candidate for dark matter. There's only one problem with axion in this scenario, in application of optical magnetometers in detection of axion-like particle, is that they wouldn't really give us any signatures in our detectable signatures in our optical signal. So this is a Maxim's idea when he came to us and said, well, but if there is any structure of this field, when you go from one domain wall to one domain to the other, you have to cross the wall. And of course, when you cross the wall, your scalar field becomes a vector field. And then this may couple to your spins, giving some torque on your precession. And we did some estimate, and it seems, I mean, it's at the first sight, it looks pretty doable. So what we did, we looked into this a little more detail, and we see what we can do about this scheme. So we have this axion-like field with domain wall structure that comes through our system. We assume something about the domain wall size and about the energy of our system, and it appears that many of this, when you measure for long enough time, practically every single type of magnetometer would probe some significant parameter space of this model. So this is one. Then,
wait. I mean, there is a very substantial prior to this, right? I mean, you are drawing that the sensitivity curve, assuming that the walls exist.
Sure.
Right. I mean, this is a very substantial assumption, right? So if they don't exist, I mean, nothing of this sort would make any sense, right? Yeah.
Want to say something?
Yeah. That's part of the reason why we're here, but you know, I think you can say that this demonstrates that the system is sensitive to parameter space that's not probed by other experiments. I think that's part of the demonstration. So it's true. This is model dependent, obviously, but it's looking for something different that
everybody else
might wonder, maybe this everything that this could ever see has been ruled out by other laboratory experiments, maybe. And this says, well, maybe not. So. And maybe there's a significant region of parameter space that's still to be explored of
right.
Some types of theories that.
All right, I understand this. Right? So, and another thing, what is the assumption about collision time? I mean, what's the time between collisions?
Okay, so this sitting here, it's the size of it's 1/100th of the light year. So the size there.
So the one collision per what? Per 10 years?
Per 10 years.
Okay.
Actually, that's the second slide. Okay, go ahead. I'm sorry.
But then it cannot be dark matter, right? Because then it cannot move at the speed of light if it's dark matter.
No, it's not speed of light. It's 10^-3.
It's 10^-3.
10^-3.
Yeah, but sitting in a galaxy frame. Yeah. Okay. So there's another question: how long? I mean, if we plan an experiment, we have to ask ourselves how long we have to perform this, and there's no natural, as I understand, there's a natural time scale in this experiment. So we try to rationalize this by saying, you know, we have to measure until Dima goes to retirement. That's actually a real assumption. That is a real assumption, but of course Dima is never going to retire, so man, this is gonna last forever. So we assume 10 years. If you assume 10 years, so there's a time scale. So if you assume something about this field, this potential axiom-like, this scalar, pseudo-scalar field, then you'll get how long you have to measure. Interestingly, you don't have to measure to already probe some significant and already unconstrained part of the of this parameter space. You don't have to measure for too long, because within a day you already constrain some of the parameter space that you are. That might be interesting in this system. But of course, if you want to really run it for 10 years, this is extremely demanding experiment. So I have like 7 minutes, so maybe just briefly tell us what we did as a proof of principle experiment. So we took two magnetometers, one running in Krakow, one running in Berkeley, 9,000 kilometers separation between these two sites. And you see signals from these two magnetometers. This is one of the very few occasions that our magnetometer is quieter than Berkeley magnetometer. It happens very rarely, let's say. So you see, this is our trace. This is Dima's trace. So as you see, these two signals are very different, right? So it would be unfair to compare them as to do some statistical analysis on this, because one is much more noisy, the other one is drifting much more. So you have to do something with this. And then this is a couple of our LIGO friends, who collaborators, who told us, well, try to apply some of our data processing algorithms. So the first things we do, we make these two signals look more or less alike. So they are Gaussian distributed, zero mean unit variance data. And then when you do this, you can try to identify some frequencies in your signal that appears. So this is Berkeley signal when we are measuring. This is over at this axis is time. Here are some different frequencies, and then you see some energy that is deposited in this signal. So we have these two plots, and now what we would assume to do, you can overlay two plots on one on the top of the other, and say, okay, look, these are together, so that's probably some correlations between these two signals. But of course, they are much more advanced. So first, what they do, they take these two plots and they overlay them at the position where there shouldn't be any signal between them. So it allows one to measure the background of this system. When you can do this, when you estimate what your background is, you can come back and look for some real signals, real correlations, or at least something that should be real, and then overlay this on this plot. And then what we saw is that everything what we saw in our system is nice, which is actually pretty good, because if we measure something for the first time for like 3 hours and there would be something, it would be really bad. So
really good.
Okay, so this was a proof of principle experiment, and now we are really seriously thinking about this experiment. We are building two apparati in Krakow, one, and in Heward with Derek builds another one. This new apparati is based on Mike Romalis's idea of having a comagnetometer, the device that is predominantly sensitive to some exotic couplings to your spins. So this would be optimized for our measurement. And of course, as we said, we want to measure for 24/7 for as long as possible. So we have to have our system being optimized and probably nobody working on this, fully automatized. So this is what we need to develop in our system. And finally, we have to look a little more onto our data processing techniques and find different or better or more sophisticated ways of not only correlating data, but also vetoing any fake signals, any false positive signals in our system. And last but not least, that's why we are here, because we are looking for different ideas. Because if you want to run for 10 years, and after 10 years you'll tell your graduate student, oh, it's zero. I'm sorry.
It's likely to be zero.
Of course,
right?
It's likely to be zero. Of course, naturally. But so we should look for some other inspirations for this measurement. And this is actually a pretty good moment because we are building the apparatus. So if there are some different demands that we should look into, then this is good. So this is a group of people who is involved in this activity right now. And let me conclude with this picture. When I gave this talk roughly half a year ago in Poland, one of the professors approached me after the talk, after several years, said, you know, I was thinking about you. This is really great idea, and I have something for you. So this is what he gave me. He said, water boiled with a hammer, even for very long time, stays unboiled. And I don't have to convince you that even if this is true, it still may be a lot of fun of doing it, right? Thank you very much for your attention. Derek?
Okay, should I do something? Are there questions?
It takes some time for the domain wall across the Earth. Is it like many seconds, 10 seconds or something?
It depends. It's
a free parameter in the theory, right? But kind of the amplitude of the field times the span of the field.
Right. Or I guess, sorry, if you
want... convoluted together, and the size of the domain convoluted together, not to... over close.
Right, absolutely. Yeah, the width of the wall is a big problem.
Right,
that's true. But like when a certain place.
You know, if it's a super thin, it's such, you know, will be such a high frequency transition for them that they're not going to see it. Right? So the optimal we start looking at it, it's like a few hundred meters, which means 10 minus 8.
But then the
yeah.
Same. Actually,
I would like to maybe slightly object, because when you have a very thin wall, it means you have a strong gradient, so the integral wouldn't really change. So if we're not looking at the dynamics of the crossing,
right.
But at
if,
the cumulative
if it's a signature of
yeah.
sudden change, right?
And that's what kind of what we're trying to do.
But then presumably the like when the wall first hits, or even if it's a 100-meter wall, roughly it's much smaller than the size of the Earth. When it hits one magnetometer, when it hits the other magnetometer, those are spaced by about 10 seconds or something.
Right.
Is that about right?
I mean, sure.
Yeah. And I can jump in, but
If it's a domain wall geometry, you need like 5 stations to completely determine
how it goes
and the velocity.
But there's another thing, you know, you don't know how you hit the wall, right? So it can be even if the wall is thick, but you are attacking it at some very strange angle, then again, it's going to last forever.
Yeah, and maybe two follow-up points to those things.
Yeah.
I mean, I think in terms of the range of parameters, you know, you can imagine, you know, in general, something that's traveling through the Earth at the speed of light. So our parameter is optimized to, hopefully, we want to optimize it so you can catch something that's coming through the station at the speed of light,
yeah,
or something that's coming through at 1,000th the speed of light, and we feel like that's pretty much the two plausible ranges. And then also, this is exactly the problem of LIDO for their separate detectors, so we've got well-characterized systems.
Is that why you've always thought of domain walls rather than like strings, because of the geometry, you need something big that passes through everything at once?
Yeah, we're afraid of missing the string, but...
Well, but
like
a thick
string,
rational
argument is around.
That I agree. Even the, you know, and monopoles would be even better, you know, dark matter, because you know the point like particles, right? But here we want to
explore
right. But strings, of course.
And what about other topological defects, textures and things? Would you say a texture passing through, or is that just?
You can explore that.
Yeah, of course.
I guess it's the axion wind is sort of
yeah.
Well, it's a continuous thing,
well,
right?
Yeah.
But
if you have monopoles, you know, maybe what one could do is to have several sort of densely packed detectors, right? So,
true.
Yeah, that's right. It's
that's
like for the like 2D defect, right? It's better probably to distribute them in a larger.
Well, it's like a dark matter particle.
That's
so
right. But if it's
like
say the size of this room and it's you know 0D from looking from you know outside, then of course it might be more beneficial to have several magnetometers in the room, right? So.
But then the correlation, right, which we are based on, right? You want to get rid of the noise as good as possible. So if something is happening locally,
yeah.
That would not
so,
you would not. Win,
yeah,
not.
just like waves, you know, you need to have very good background suppression, and then
yeah.
Without a single ear attack, you know, how can those people it's not noise?
So since we discussed various, you know, possible signatures or you know morphology of possible exotic signals. Another thing that here we assume that the signal occurs only when the wall is crossing at this very moment, right? Or some defect is crossing. Another possibility we discussed yesterday could be, say, domains of you know Mike is looking for some you know vector in space, right? For example, right? So there could be domains of these vectors in space so that, you know, over 24 hours they average out, right? But we might pass through some domains, you know, like the signal exists, but, you know, it's slight chaotic rotation, right? As you move from one domain into another. So that's, the same can be thought of alpha as well, right? So that you go from one domain with one value of coupling to a slightly different domain with, different domain with a slightly different value of coupling. So
it should be a small domain.
Slightly different would be different morphology. Right?
But much smaller, right? I mean, the domain would be much smaller.
Yeah, if I make one magnetic domain that we go through it in 24 hours, Mike's, you don't need the. Correlated magnetometers, you will.
Like you said, the North Pole, so
you will probably detect it through some.
Well, it depends on if it's the same or the size of the Earth's orbit around the Sun.
Right, but what I'm trying to say, if there is like a structure of domains that with these are certain orientation of this B field. Small B, right?
Yeah.
What you're looking for, but on average, it averages to zero, but it still will be signal, during a short duration. So,
well, when it does our experiment every 20 seconds, but if it causes just some extra noise in our signal.
No, but your signal is like 24 hour modulation.
Well,
not
necessarily.
Right?
We could see that.
Okay, well, thanks, Shimon. Oh, wait, one more question.
Yeah.
All right.
It's a bit more polite, but do you have any sensitivity?